It's Emily here, and today I want to invite you to make sure to check out Robinhood Integrative Health. If you are a resident of the Winston-Salem, North Carolina area, and you're looking for a doctor who treats you differently, looks deeper into the issues that you're having, and seeks to hear you as a person and really help to get you better, then I can't recommend Robinhood Integrative Health, where Dr. Wiggy practices, enough. Make sure that you go to their website and see how you can benefit from their services today. And did you know that they even take some insurances, which basically never happens in integrative medicine? So make sure to check them out and enjoy the episode.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Healthy Discourse. It's Emily here, and I'm very excited to welcome today's guest, Susan Salinger, to the program. Hey, Susan, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I am doing great, thank you. I'm so excited to have Susan on the show because she has written a book that I've honestly not read yet, but I'm very excited to talk to her about why she wrote this book, some of her findings, and then how we can use this information moving forward, especially as women. So this one is for the ladies today. Susan wrote a book called Sidelined: How Women Can Navigate a Broken Healthcare System, which examines the many ways in which some women manage and sometimes mismanage their healthcare. And if you've been around Healthy Discourse for a while, you know we talk a lot about healthcare here, and we definitely talk about the broken healthcare system. So once again, Susan, welcome. I'm so happy to hear that you wrote this book, and I'm excited to dig into some of the details that you found in your research and so forth.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It was a terrifically interesting book to write.
I have no doubt. So tell us about that. What was it that motivated you to even delve into this topic and to begin researching for this book?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I'll try to make it shorter. But many, many years ago, when I was in my 20s, actually, or maybe 30s, I can't remember anymore, I agreed to have some surgery that I knew I didn't need. I mean, I had changed medications. All of a sudden, I had symptoms. So obviously, to me, it was obvious that the symptoms were due to the new medication. And the doctor completely disagreed, insisted I have surgery. I knew he was wrong, but yet I agreed to it anyway. I was young. I was frightened. I had young kids at the time. All right. So I agreed to the surgery. He was wrong. Everything was fine. And, you know, life goes on. So then after, you know, let's fast forward to about 20 or 30 years later. After that, I retired. My husband and I sold our business. And so I went back to school because retirement, I was bored out of my mind. So I went back to school and I took some anthropology classes and I ended up doing a project on women with hysterectomies. I don't even remember why I picked that particular topic, but I did. And the women I interviewed that had had hysterectomy, several of them had agreed to have the hysterectomy surgery, even though they didn't think they needed it either. And that really, of course, acted as a trigger. And I mean, my surgery, I was fine, but their surgery was irrevocable. I mean, it was a whole different thing. So that really made me wonder, how do we make our medical decisions? What goes into our decision-making? So that point, I started interviewing a whole bunch of women. I must have interviewed 50 or 60 women, all with different diseases, just looking to see what they had in common. How did they make their decisions? How did they react to their doctors, et cetera? And I found quite a few things they had in common, and it was just really interesting.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? What were some of the things that we found in common? And it's so interesting. I had no idea you were going to say that, but I feel like people have unnecessary surgeries and organ removal often without ever having a chance to dig deeper and figure out, why am I having this problem? What is the root cause of it? And is jumping to remove organs or have back surgery or fill in the blank actually what's best for me and what's needed? So what were some of the common themes that you were hearing?
Well, I will get to that, but one of the common things I found, and I really want to respond to what you just said because I agree with it so completely, is that women hesitate to get second opinions. I did not get a second opinion. I mean, I was a kid and I didn't do it. And let's look at my own surgery, for example. All right, so I had symptoms. I could have gone back on, I had options. I could have gone back on the old medication and see if the symptoms disappeared. I could have gotten a second opinion. I could have done research on the new drug that he gave me and tried to figure out what, if any, side effects there were. I mean, I wasn't going to keel over in 24 hours. I certainly could have given myself a week or two to figure this out, and I didn't. And then when I researched for the book, many of the women, in fact, I would say well over half of them hesitated to get second opinions. At the time I did my research, I researched that women hesitate to get second opinions more than men do. I don't know if that's still true today. My research now is about a year old. And so that, I mean, a year, a lot happens. But we don't want to be rude and we don't want to hurt the doctor's feelings. And one woman told me she'd never get a second opinion because she was afraid she'd be labeled a bad patient and that would be put in her chart and it would follow her throughout her medical career. So I so agree with you that we all agree too quickly to have medical procedures, surgeries, and sometimes these are major surgeries and they're like a hysterectomy and they're called procedures, which dumbs down the phrase. We really need to get second opinions and we really need to do our own research. And so many of us don't. And that was one of the main things I found that these women had in common.
That's interesting.
I think the other thing I found that sort of surprised me is that women put themselves last. There was a study done where researchers gave women a list of five things to prioritize. You know, what would they take care of first? And first, they take care of, I shouldn't say they, we take care of our children. And secondly, we take care of our pets. I loved that. And third, we take care of our elderly parents, which as an elderly parent myself, I resented, but there it is. And fourth, we take care of our significant others. And last, but certainly not least, we take care of ourselves. And I found that over and over in my interviews. We talked earlier, Emily and I talked earlier about the fact that her husband is a doctor and he finds that women really go to the doctor more than men do. And in a sense, I found, yes, we do. I mean, absolutely. But at the same time, we don't always go for ourselves. We're there with our parents or we're there with our children, or it takes us so long to get there because we're not feeling quite right. And we mean to go to the doctor, but the kids have a play at school and there's a project at work and I've got all this to do and all that to do. So I know I'll get there next week. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I heard that.
Yeah. Well, and I think what makes his practice different is he's seeking for root causes and he's also solving a lot of mysteries. And arguably, he's working with a different demographic that, number one, does prioritize their health. These are people that desire to become and stay healthy, number one, but also a lot of the people that he sees are those that are very complicated, very complex, have decades of experiences where they've been dismissed by traditional medicine. They've been told that it's all in their head. They've been told that they're fine. They've been told they just need to go on antidepressants or birth control or fill in the blank and not really listened to or heard. And therefore, their chronic illnesses have become worse and worse. And so I think that's probably a big piece of it too, that they find him and they desire to keep coming because he's fixing a lot of long-term problems and he listens to the patient and doesn't dismiss their symptoms, their feelings, their fill in the blank of what they're bringing to him. So it's probably a little bit different. That said, I have had several close people in my life lately share with me things I have been told to them by both female and male doctors or medical providers who have really spoken in demeaning ways to them about the way that they parent, that they're causing certain things in their children, that I that you know all of this kind of thing where it's just I feel like there's the more time that goes on, the more there's almost this elitist attitude in traditional medicine that I'm the authority. We saw this a lot during COVID. I'm in charge, we're the experts, and you're supposed to listen to me. Rather than I'm a trusted partner in your healthcare and I want to be part of helping you make the best decisions for yourself with informed consent and so forth. And I find that that's gone out the window so much in the way that traditional medicine is practiced. Would you say that in the women that you interviewed that they felt like they were dismissed or that they were judged or cajoled or whatever into decisions or told what to do without being given options? That was a lot. I just gave you like
No,
six.
I hear you. I heard every word and I was nodding my head for those of you that can't see. But no, absolutely I do. And I'll tell you, it's kind of just a quick bizarre story. I just interviewed a woman yesterday for my new book, and she has heart attacks run in her family. And she had her first heart attack at 30 something, it doesn't matter what, 30, whatever. And she went into the hospital emergency with all of the symptoms of a heart attack. She was nauseous, she was sweating, she had pain in her arm, pain in her, I mean, it was an, I could have diagnosed it as a heart attack. I mean, it was ridiculous. And so the emergency doctor said, "Well, you're probably pregnant." And she said, "No, I'm not pregnant. I had a hysterectomy, so I know I'm not pregnant." And he said, "Well, I'll run a pregnancy test." And she said, "No, I had a hysterectomy. I'm not pregnant." And he said, "Well, I'll run a pregnancy test." And she said, "No, I've had this hysterectomy." So he ran the pregnancy test and he came back and he said, "No, you're really not pregnant. You've had a hysterectomy." Well, I mean, come on. So that was
Oh
a
my
bizarre story.
goodness.
Can you believe that?
I honestly can. I mean, I had one of my dearest friends is trying to find the root cause of some significant nausea and so forth that her daughter's been experiencing. And because of her symptoms and because she's such a good researcher, they eliminated gluten and dairy for a while. The nausea is continuing. So, but she was sharing this. And she was told that she was the problem, that she had was giving, creating anxiety in her daughter, and that she needed to go see a food psychologist. And I about hit the ground. I was like,
Yes.
what
Yes.
in the world? That
Yes.
as if, and we tell patients and we tell people on our podcast all the time, you have to be your own and your family's advocate. And you actually do have to learn some things about all of this because, and go in with a little bit more of an educated perspective, but
Yeah.
also be your own advocate because no one else is going to do it for you. To go
That's
in and
absolutely right.
be willing to say, no, I'm the one making the decisions for myself and for my children. I'm the parent, or it's for me. I find this happening with parents so often now, this like, oh, I'm the expert, so I decide for your kids. And that's just so frustrating because, again, we're supposed to have partnerships with our medical providers. They're not supposed to be dictators.
Well, how do I say this? I'm agreeing with everything yet again. My thoughts are all jumbled. I think, well, the first thing I want to do is start with just a quick story that happened to me personally. When my daughter was young, she had TMJ, which is a problem with her jaw. And every time she opened her mouth and chewed, but the jaw would crack, and it can be quite painful. So at that time, there was some surgery that one could do that they would remove. It's a question of the disc in the jaw. And anyway, I don't want to get into the science of it, but they would replace the disc with a Teflon disc, and that would theoretically cause the problem. So, but what I didn't know, and my husband and I went to, I think, seven doctors, literally seven. We were in LA, so we had plenty of choices, and thank God the resources to do this. But anyway, so my husband went with me to every appointment, and there was a split in the dental community at that time, and literally 50% of the dental community said, "You absolutely have to have this surgery. It's a lifesaver." The other half said, "Whatever you do, don't have this surgery." Okay, so we go to one woman, And she said, who was in the, yes, you need to have surgery camp. She looked directly at me, not at my husband. And she said, you absolutely must allow your daughter to have this surgery. And if you don't, you need psychological counseling as to why you're competing with your very beautiful teenage daughter. Okay.
Oh.
Can you imagine? So the next
time. Unfortunately, I can, because you just reminded me of something else that's happening so much lately in the with the transgender youth occurrences and what parents are being told when they're not willing to affirm that they must go along with invasive, lifelong altering treatments, or else they are going to have a suicidal child.
Right.
One leads to the other. Of course, that's a whole other issue, it's the same thing. It becomes this judgment on my parenting child best.
And well, then we went to another doctor who absolutely felt I should not have, Lisa should not have this surgery. And he looked at me and he said, well, you know, not all parents need their children to be perfect. And incidentally, my husband was with me at all of the appointments. They all looked at me. Nobody addressed him. But one was competing with her and the other thought I was trying to make her perfect. And as it happens, the surgery was a total failure. Thank God we didn't do it.
That's fascinating. So both of them on two different sides were looking at you. And this is, I mean, I can't tell you how many times we've talked about this on the podcast, that you are the decision maker for your family. And that is, or for your child. Yes, mom and dad, but oftentimes moms are the ones going to the appointments and that sort of thing. And there's certain things that we know are going to be suggested that we might desire not to do or to do, that we just have to go in with confidence and say, I've made this decision. We're not doing that. And yes, you're going to be judged. And yes, people might, you know, try to say that they're the expert or whatever, but making your informed choice is what you get to do as for yourself or for your children.
Well, you know, I think, because I mean, I there's so much to say and I don't want to run out of time. You asked me what other things I found in common, and there were several. But I think what I want to make sure that I have time to say in relation to what we've just been talking about, I think when you go to the doctor, and I'd love your input on this because your husband is a doctor and I know you help run the office, et cetera. I think when you go to the doctor, the best thing you can do is be prepared. And what I mean by that is, first, and this is all in the book, but you want to go in with a written list of your symptoms. And I say written on purpose. That's the operative word. Because if you have it in your head, if you're like me, I get so anxious, it flies in one brain cell and out the other. I mean, I have no idea when I get there. I can remember 3 out of the 5 things I wanted to talk about. But if I write everything down, that has 2 benefits. One, it helps me focus the interview and get my questions answered. And second, I've been on a couple of shows with doctors, and they said they really prefer when their customer comes in with the list, because they too can review the list and they may need to change the priority. They may say that the mole on your back is more important than the fact that your throat hurts a little or whatever.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So a written list is really important. And second, I think it's really important to get the clinical name of your diagnosis and have the doctor write it down and spell it for you. And that's because you want to go home, and I presume most people today have access to a computer, or their library does. Please, please, please research your disease. Do you think the diagnosis fits? Have you had all the necessary tests for it to be adequately diagnosed? Do your symptoms match whatever the research says? You know, you want to make sure that you're being diagnosed correctly. And, you know, which I didn't know, there's about 40,000 diseases out there. So it's really easy for a doctor to screw up, and not because they're incompetent, but because there's so many diseases and so many of the symptoms mimic each other. It's just easy to make a mistake. And you know your body, and I really want to reinforce that. So if what you've researched makes sense, that's great. And if it doesn't make sense, then you need to go back and clarify. And I think the third thing to do is to say to the doctor, what else do you think this could possibly be? I know you've had a lot of experience with disease X. Have all of the people that you've seen come with my symptoms, have they all had disease X? Is there any other possibility? And hopefully there will be. And now you have two things to research, which is great. So yeah. I think those things are really important. And I think last but not least, I think it's really important to repeat back to the doctor what you've heard them say. And the reason for that is it gives you a chance to make sure that you understood correctly. It gives the doctors a chance to make sure that they said what they meant to say. I mean, we all misspeak. So it kind of clarifies the whole thing. And I think if you do that, especially the research part, you have tools that will empower you and encourage you to either get a second opinion, if that's what you think is needed, to take a little bit more charge of your own health, because it is your body. And I just want to make a quick plug for the book, because when I say research, people have asked me what I mean. There's a big resource list at the back of the book. That's the most important. I mean, don't even read the book. I mean, I hope you do, but it's the resource list that's important. It tells you how to research. It tells you how to research your hospital. Is the hospital that your doctor's affiliated with, does it specialize in cardiology or neurology? If you're having a heart condition, you would prefer, you're better off with one that specializes in cardiology, et cetera. It tells you how to research your doctor, how to research your disease, your symptoms, what tests you're having. I worked really hard on that. It's a very good resource tool. Now I'll be quiet.
No, it's great. No, I have a couple comments on that. So I think all of your tips are incredible. I will say, I know that when you come prepared for your visit and you've done your research and you're ready. I know from my husband, first of all, he loves that. And it also shows that it encourages that provider to be on their A game as well, because they know that you're there to be serious and they're going to be more serious. And that's just natural. It's just like if you show up to a meeting and the person you're meeting with brought four pages of notes, you're going to take that more seriously than someone that showed up just unprepared, because that relationship goes both ways, right? The other thing I think that I guess what makes integrative medicine a little bit differently is that we're not so focused on the diagnosis, making sure that we're diagnosing correctly. Sure, that matters a lot in some situations when you have a lethal disease or something like that, but there's so many mysteries that don't have a specific name to them. Yes. And we're so primed, especially in our Western culture, to be able to label everything, mm-hmm. right? And we want that label of that diagnosis. And sometimes if we desire that so quickly that we're not willing to go through all of the steps to dig deeper and deeper and figure out what is the root cause of this, if we go about it with that being our ultimate goal to figure out the root cause, which can hopefully be fixed or at least improved, rather than everything having a name on it. For example, fibromyalgia as an example. Yes. It's kind of one of those
basket
symptom driven. It means so many different things. And so many women, like we just want to know what it's called. Whereas that same culmination of symptoms can be so many different things. So if we're willing to pause and find a provider that's willing to keep digging, which it can be very tricky, I know, then it can be very helpful to figure out, to take our time to figure out what is the root cause rather than just having a name. Because in traditional medicine, we diagnose and then we prescribe a medication and that's it. And we diagnose and we prescribe, rather than let's keep testing to figure out what is actually happening so we can address the root cause, sometimes through medication, sometimes through lifestyle changes, supplementation, alternative treatments, whatever that might be. And so I think we have to be very assertive and we also have to be patient. The other thing about preparation is that you mentioned most physicians, especially if you're seeing a primary care physician, most of them are seeing 30 to 40 patients per day. In our practice, they see 10 to 14 patients a day, which is significantly different because we take a completely different approach. But you've got to think about that. When you show up and you're the one patient out of 40 that day that is ready and on your A game, that's when you're going to get their best too. So I love your tips. I think they were phenomenal. And those are just my comments on.
Well, I think that what you said about being patient and getting a diagnosis is critical because, you know, I think we're all in a rush, including myself. And I know better, particularly after doing this research. But there's something about having a diagnosis. I mean, there's been so much research on this. I mean, it's comforting. Look, Mom, I really am sick. I told you I was sick. You know, the doctor said I have disease X. And I think that we all rush to get that name so that we can prove maybe to ourselves and others that we're not whining. We really are sick. And I think that we do ourselves a disservice when we rush like that. I agree with you completely.
Yeah.
That patience is what it does take patience. I know with fibromyalgia and a lot of the autoimmune diseases, they mimic each other and there's not necessarily definitive blood tests.
You're right. And that's things like chronic Lyme and mold and all of these kinds of things that it takes time and it takes a process of elimination. And well, is this the chicken or the egg and all of that kind of thing. People, I mean, my husband, people will show up at appointment number one, like, I've heard great things about you. Can you please fix me? And he's like, I would love to be your partner in helping you. You know, I am not God and I cannot fix you, but we will go through the steps to, you know, but it takes work on both sides to, you know, continue trying things and committing and being consistent with the things that you're trying to make sure that we're eliminating one thing after another. So I think that for a long time, we've been in this kind of one-sided healthcare system where like, oh, we go to the doctor and we get better. And I actually think the last 4 years have open people's eyes a little bit more to being our own advocate and realizing that sometimes the narratives that are pushed upon us constantly are not always 100% true, and that we don't know everything and your doctor doesn't necessarily know everything. And to be honest, when they're seeing those 40 patients per day, they don't have a ton of time to go do research. Unless they're in a setup where they're encouraged to do that and they have an opportunity to dig deeper and they're collaborating with their peers to say, hey, what are you learning? Oh, look at this new treatment option, all that kind of thing. They just don't, and they don't learn in medical school. They don't have a chance to always learn the cutting edge, new things, do the research. A lot of it is just passed down. It's kind of like, it's just kind of projected onto them versus let's use our brains to think and figure it out. And so when we as patients or as parents of patients are getting into that thinking mindset and considering, like you said, well, what else could it be? That is so wonderful because it makes me not just default to the flow chart that I've been taught to follow, but instead to really dig deeper into what are some possibilities here. So I really, really love that one too. That's one.
Yeah, I liked that one too. Thank you. Actually, somebody suggested that to me on a podcast and I really liked it. Yeah,
that's really great. That's really great. So when, and closing with this, but I want to touch on one other thing. What would you say were like your biggest takeaways with the research and the writing that you did for this book as far as kind of where we are with medicine right now, and especially as women with what's going well, what's not going so well, and kind of just your airplane view, what are you seeing and what's happening in medicine?
You know, it's interesting that you asked that. And I guess I'm seeing two different things. I'm seeing that we're making a huge amount of progress. I mean, this is Women's History Month, and there's a history chapter in my book. And when I look back at the ancient Greeks and stuff and what they thought about women and women's bodies, we've come a hell of a long way. And I think that women do advocate for themselves. I think we still need to advocate even more. And I think we need education on the best ways to advocate. And I think that that is happening. At the same time, I see what's going on with the abortion situation and the IVF situation. And I'm not talking politically as much as I'm saying women, where I'm on the one hand, we're telling women to become educated and be in charge of their own bodies. And on the other hand, we're saying, well, you can't be in charge of your own body because you're not qualified, or I don't believe what you believe, or whatever. So I'm torn on how to answer that, because I see a split right down the middle.
Oh, wow. Over there's here. A whole other podcast there.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
As someone personally who values the life of every child in the womb, and I see that differently, because I see that as that's not my body. That is its own body. And I have a responsibility as the child bearer for that body. I see that a little bit differently.
I can understand that.
But your big picture premise as far as and I think we can make the same argument when it comes to sports. So as women, like, we fought for Title IX, and now we have men that are competing in women's sports. So there's no safe spaces for women anymore, right? So what is a woman? That's a whole other thing. I do think that we live in a very complicated, confusing culture that makes it very difficult. I'm kind of glad that I had my baby girl when I was much older.
Yeah.
And I have a lot more, or I hope that I will, because when she's in her adolescence, I'll be in my 50s. Then I feel like I'm going to bring a lot more wisdom to the table than I would have had if I had her when I was 20. So I'm grateful for that, because it is such a complicated time to be a woman and to figure out, what are we supposed to be doing here? And what does this actually mean? And are we speaking on the same term? So I think you're right. I agree. It's very confusing, and we're making progress in some ways and not as much in other ways. And I think that's one of those things where we have to look at this from all angles and say, okay, what does progress really mean?
Yes, and maybe it means different things to different people. The right to life, half of the population probably thinks that that's great progress. The people that aren't the right to, I don't know what you call the other group, the pro-abortion group, thinks that's great progress. I mean, you know.
Right. I agree. It's very complicated. And unfortunately, what we call this podcast, Healthy Discourse, because we love to have hard conversations with people that we don't necessarily all agree with everything. My husband and I don't always agree on everything. People love to listen to us politely banter with each other on the podcast.
We did that too.
Yeah, it's a lot of, exactly. If we can do more of that rather than cancellation fighting, this huge divisiveness, then we have so much more potential to actually come up with solutions versus being further divided on everything. So, all right, Susan. So I've got to ask you, you are 81 years old and a power lifter. So I'm pretty sure you became my hero in that. When did you start? We didn't talk about this earlier, but I've been in fitness for, I don't know, 20 years in different capacities, but tell me how you got into powerlifting and what is your key to be able to keep doing it at 81, because I need to be like you when I grow up.
Oh, are you a lovely person? Okay. Well, I got into it because when I was in my 30s, whatever the hell it was, I was diagnosed with osteoporosis. And the doctor at the time told me I could very well be one of those women who stepped off a curb and broke all her bones. And I thought, well, screw that, if you'll pardon me. That's not going to work for me. And so I went home, researcher that I was even then, and looked up osteoporosis, and it said to do resistance training and impact exercises. So I started walking, which bored the hell out of me, but I did do it. And then I started with the weights, and I love lifting weights. Yeah, I'm competitive with myself. And you know, when you start at 2 pounds, and then you go to 4 pounds, and then you go to 8 pounds, you can see the progress. So what, and so I've just kept going because I've been really healthy all my life, which is, I mean, I must say it's good. I have excellent genes. My parents were very healthy. Even my in-laws were healthy. You know, I have very good genes, but I also have had a lot of good luck. I've never fallen or been hit by a truck, but I've also really watched my diet, and I am very much into the powerlifting. It does bore me, although lately it bores me less because I can see how well I'm doing. And I have to say, for being 81 and looking back on it, besides, the part I can't control is the genes and the luck. But I have to tell you that I'm positive the powerlifting has really, really, really helped me. You guys can't see me, but I mean, I look 81. It's not my face, but I walk like a 40 or 50 year old. I'm bench press. You can't see me. I'm 4'10". I weigh 100 pounds. I mean, I'm this little old woman, and I can bench press 50 pounds. I mean, that's amazing. Oh, it is. Yes. You should see me with these big heavy weights. I get so excited.
I know 80 year olds that can't lift up 2 pounds. So that's absolutely amazing. And I know that it's got to keep you invigorated and independent and be able to do so many things and to live a full life into your 80s, which is what I fully desire, because I think that we in the same realm of topics, like when we don't prioritize the things that matter when they matter, and I guess when we have young children and that sort of thing, because if we're not strong and healthy and feeling energized ourselves, and there's no way we can take care of everyone well. That's just not possible.
And I do Pilates too. I love Pilates twice a week on the weightlifting, and I do Pilates three. I've turned into a gym rat, which I never. I mean, I hated it all my life, but Pilates helped with balance and coordination. And I mean, I've never fallen. You know, I want to say I'm really lucky, but I work at it. You know, Jane Fonda once said, and I really agree with her, that the best way to handle old age is to prepare for it. And I think if you exercise and really do it diligently, and trust me, it's boring. I basically hate it, but I love what it does for me. I love what it does.
I feel like getting started, as the older I get, getting started can be more challenging, but in the middle of it, I'm like, this is the best thing ever. You know, there's just something about a hard workout, especially with weights, like conquered something that day. And I love that. So,
And I need to have an appointment I need to have a trainer or somebody, because otherwise I don't show up. I need the discipline of having to meet somebody at 3 o'clock or whatever time it, you know what I'm saying.
Okay. I love it. Well, thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom and expertise with us. And another plug for the book, it's called Sidelined. I'll be sure to share the link in the notes. And I just really appreciate you coming on to share your research and your power lifting and book, and hopefully women can walk away with this saying, oh yeah, I need to be more prepared when I go to the doctor next time.
Yes,
and I'll definitely be checking out that resources section myself as well. So thank you again for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.